Hungry Humans. Part 1.
This is the battlefield, a manifestation of humans' cruelty. Everything happens fast and in a riotous way in the battlefield. But sometimes wars are silent and hidden with an attractive and charming look. Such wars are sometimes more threatening and result in more victims. Like the war that I want to tell you about. A war that you may not have even imagined, but we are in the middle of the battlefield. I want to start my story with a question. Why is fast food so popular in this era? One recipe and one taste. Everything is similar. Ready-to-eat foods are without stories because there is no time to tell stories in the middle of the battlefield. We can find them in these hypermarkets. There is no story here. The story of each product is summarized in barcodes and a few lines and numbers below them. It doesn't matter where the food comes from, they say here instead of everywhere. Here, like on the battlefield, everything happens fast. Undoubtedly, every food has a story, even if we don't have time to hear it. Foods sometimes make up their own stories, which are sometimes scary and bitter. The scary story of Zahak started from the kitchen. Foods have their own stories and make up other stories, like potatoes. The potato. How the Humble Spud Rescued the Western World is the name of a book by Larry Zuckerman. It is about the potato and its relationship with the Industrial Revolution. Who would believe that potatoes played a key role in one of the biggest events in human history? I asked Larry Zuckerman how potatoes suddenly became a widespread food in the world.
So I would not say that it caused the Industrial Revolution, but I would go so far as to say that in England, it helped make the Industrial Revolution possible because it sustained the people who were doing the industry. When factory workers got off shift, the last thing they really wanted to do was cook. And right outside the factory gates were people who had set up carts with ovens, and they would bake the potatoes. And they would sell them for cheap, and people would have a hot baked potato coming right off the factory floor, a nice instant treat. And that was, in a sense, the beginning of modern street food. So the pace of life began to increase. I think the industrialization happened first, and the potato became necessary for it to continue, or made it easier.
Larry, what was the main issue, the key issue that made potato one of the widespread food in that era? Were the factories or industrialization the main reason?
There's a point about the world moving faster. So it's not just that people moved to factories, it's that life itself was speeding up tremendously, that there were fewer holidays even, that there was less time in the day to do things, that cooking, you wanted something that was fast. Potatoes were easy. It saved time, it saved labor. So that's the way that I think of the potato being as a labor-saving device. That's the way that the potato helped the age of fast food. Today, I mean, it's like, there's no time for anything.
The potato story was about pace. Life had become too fast. In that era, people were in a hurry for everything. Street food was a new way to save time. Street foods are prepared in the shortest time and can be eaten anywhere. Then there was enough time for people to do more important things than cooking and eating. In those days, people tried to spend their time to produce more products. After many years doing the same thing, people realized that they were producing much more goods than they needed. People had to consume more goods because production was increasing. Otherwise, there would be no production. In this way, humans enter the era of mass consumption. Mass production and consumption meant that previous methods had to be changed. For example, the chicken meat and beef consumed by humans were obtained from farms in the past, but in that era, the farms could not supply this amount of meat anymore. So industrial livestock production came into existence. Animal husbandry describes how animals gain a lot of weight in a short time. For example, the weight that chickens gain in 6 weeks in today's industrial poultry farming is almost twice the weight that chicks gained in the same period of time 50 years ago in farms. This rapid growth of chicken in a short time and under unusual conditions inflicted a lot of pain on them in their short life, kind of pain that few people have heard about. Earlier I said that foods in the new supermarkets do not have a story, but it is better to say that they have a story, but it is not written anywhere. Peter Singer, he's one of the greatest philosophers in the world. He wrote a book on the story of pain. In his book, Animal Liberation, he talks about the great pain that industrial animal production inflicts on animals. This is the last chapter of the short life of industrial chickens. I asked Peter Singer what made a philosopher like him write a book about the short and painful life of these animals.
Well, I am primarily concerned about the suffering we inflict on animals. I think we should not do that as an ethical imperative. I think in the way we treat animals, especially in factory farms, it is indisputable. So many people, when they think about animals being farmed, they think of animals outside grazing in the fields. But unfortunately, over the past 50 years, in many countries, animals, or most animals, are no longer in the fields.
Can you give us a talk about the suffering imposed, for example, to hens in factory farming?
In some cases, the confinement is very tight. An example of that would be for hens who are laying eggs. So the standard industrial cage, and that's not just for one hen, that might be for four or five hens. So each hen in this cage has just a very small amount of space. They're very crowded together and they can't even stretch their wings. In fact, some of the cages are so small that even one bird in the cage could not stretch her wings fully. And instead of there being one bird, there are four or five birds. Now, as well as the crowding, inability to move freely or stretch limbs, there is also a high level of aggression. When you put hens so close to each other that they can't escape, then the more aggressive birds can attack the weaker birds. And in order to prevent the more aggressive birds from actually killing the weaker birds, they cut off the sharp point of the beak. But the operation of cutting off the end of the beak is itself a very painful operation. Also, the chickens are raised for meat, not in cages, but they are extremely crowded. Maybe 20,000 birds in a single shed. In terms of the amount of space that each bird has, it's roughly one sheet of paper, so it's roughly that much space that a meat chicken has. And the crowding causes a lot of stress. Also, the birds bred to grow very quickly. What that means is that the birds are very young and their leg bones are not mature, but they're eating all the time and they're putting on a lot of weight. For many of the birds, actually, it's painful simply to stand up because their leg bones are so weak that they bend under the weight, and in some cases, actually, the legs collapse. And if the legs collapse, the birds just die because they can no longer move, they can no longer get to food or water.
Mass and high-speed production of food was not possible without the help of machines, so foods were produced by machines. Machines did not show mercy to animals either. It means that humans did not program the machines for such aim. Important that animals had souls, emotions, and feelings. From then on, animals were just goods that had to be reproduced, sold, and consumed rapidly. Whatever Peter Singer explained about the industrial animal production in chickens' case fits about cows and calves and industrial cattle farming too. It refers to raising a large number of cows in very large dairy farms with conditions that were unimaginable before this era. In these farms, cows have to eat more to grow faster. Fast production of meat and milk should be done in any possible way. There had to be changes in the stomach or the feeding method of cows so that they could eat more and more. Cows couldn't grow as fast as possible by eating natural fodder considering the amount of market demand. So farmers had to look for other materials for cow feed. So corn became a key element in the cow's growth. This large amount of corn had to be produced so that they could eat and grow faster. The new issue was the mass production of corn. This amount of corn should have been produced in the shortest time. Statistics of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations show the world production of corn increased sevenfold between 1995 and 2005. This rapid growth was achieved at the cost of the destruction of a large part of the Amazon forest and other arable lands of this planet. According to statistics, 67% of the world's agricultural lands have been infertile. The cruel cycle of industrial meat production does not spare even oil, and they use a large amount of this fossil fuel for tractors and food delivery trucks. According to the statistics, it takes 5 barrels of oil to grow a beef cattle. Numbers show for every 120 grams of beef, 7.5 square meters of fertile forests are destroyed, and as a result, 240 kilograms of carbon dioxide are released. More and faster production of food causes a lot of suffering for animals and also causes a lot of damage to nature.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Britain's cost of living crisis is worsening, with food price inflation at its highest level since the 2008 financial crisis. The sharp rise in prices is pushing up the average annual household bill as Britain's poor struggle to pay rising energy bills. Despite the relative decrease in the inflation index last month, for the month of August in England, statistics show that volume of retail sales decreased more than expected during this period, and this is a sign that England is moving towards economic recession. We are prepared for you a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency writes, Britain's economy grew by less than expected in July, raising the risk that it is already in a recession, with the sharp climb in energy tariffs hurting demand for electricity and a leap in the cost of materials hitting the construction sector. Recent official data showed with inflation at a 40-year high of more than 10%, gross domestic product, or GDP, expanded by 0.2% from June, weaker than a median forecast of 0.4%. In the 3 months to July, gross domestic product was flat compared with the previous three-month period. Some economists said recent data suggested the economy might be on course to shrink in the July-September period, having contracted by 0.1% in the April to June quarter. Jake Finney, an economist at PwC, said, "This would mean that Britain enters a technical recession for the first time since lockdown restrictions ended." Paul Dales at Capital Economics said, "A disappointingly small rebound in real gross domestic product in July suggests that the economy has little momentum and is probably already in recession." In August, the Bank of England forecast a recession for the world's fifth biggest economy, lasting from end of 2022 until early 2024, due in large part to a hit to living standards from energy prices pushed up by the war in Ukraine. But recently, new UK Prime Minister Liz Truss announced a cap on domestic energy tariffs, which, along with an expected round of tax cuts, reduces the risk of such a protracted hit to Britain's economy, albeit at a cost of £100 billion, or $116 billion, or more to Britain's already stretched public finances. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, said anecdotal evidence suggested that the surge in power prices was changing consumer behavior and demand for energy had fallen. Separate trade figures also showed the impact of soaring prices, with the value of imports of fuel hitting an all-time high of £11 billion in the month of July and representing a record 21% of all goods imported into Britain. The Financial Times also reports on the same story. Sterling slid to its lowest level since 1985 against the US dollar on Friday, 16th of September, after a round of weaker-than-expected data on UK retail sales amplified concerns that the country was headed for a prolonged recession. The pound dropped as much as 1% to 1.135 per dollar, the first time it has breached the 1.14 mark in almost four decades. It rose back to just above $1.14 in New York trading, but remains down almost 16% in 2022. The currency's sharp decline reflects a broad rally this year in the dollar, as well as particular concerns over Britain's economy. Sterling was off about 0.5% on Friday against the euro at 1.141 euros, leaving it down about 4% this year. According to data published on Friday, 16th of September, by the Office for National Statistics, retail sales fell sharply in August as British consumers struggled with soaring prices and high energy costs. The quantity of goods bought in the UK fell 1.6% between July and August, reversing a small expansion in the previous month. This was a larger drop than the 0.5% contraction forecast by economists polled by Reuters news agency and the latest fall since July 2021, when COVID-19 restrictions on hospitality were lifted. Olivia Cross, economist at Capital Economics, said the figure suggested that the downward momentum is gathering speed and supported her view that the economy is already in recession. The Office of National Statistics said that rising prices and cost of living pressures were affecting sales volumes, which have continued the downward trend since the summer of 2021, following the reopening of the economy after pandemic lockdowns. The figures highlighted how high inflation has hit consumers and a wider economy. The government's £150 billion energy support package announced this month is expected to limit the blow from the recent surge in gas prices, but it did not dispel the risk of a recession. Victoria Scholar, head of the investment at Interactive Investor, said, "The fact that the sterling fell against both the US dollar and the euro on Friday showed that that is not a dollar move, but in fact, it is traders selling the pound amid negative sentiment towards Britain's economic outlook and investment case." The website of Turkey's Anadolu news agency covers the same story but from a different angle. A think tank said in its report British households' spending power is expected to be slashed by an average of £3,000 by the end of the year as living standards drop by the largest margin in a century. The report prepared by the Resolution Foundation, an independent think tank focused on improving living standards for those on low to middle incomes, said that household incomes are expected to fall by 10% this year as well as in next year. This means real earnings would fall at the fastest rate since 1997 and that by mid-2023, real pay growth since 2003 would be erased. Together, the number of those in absolute poverty would increase by as much as 3 million. The Resolution Foundation said that these estimates already include the government's existing £30 billion package to support, announced in March. Inflation in Britain is now in the double digits, 10.1%, in its highest level in the past 40 years, driven mainly by surging energy prices. The think tank called for tens of billions of pounds of further government support. Lalitha Tri, a researcher at the Resolution Foundation, said that the future of British living standards look terrifying. She said typical households are on course to see their real incomes fall by £3,000 over the next 2 years. The biggest squeeze is at least a century, while 3 million extra people could fall into the poverty trap. No responsible government could accept such an outlook, so radical policy action is required to address it. We're going to need an energy support package worth tens of billions of pounds, completed with increasing benefits next year for October's inflation rate. Lalitha Tri added, the new Prime Minister also needs to improve Britain's longer-term outlook, which can only be achieved by a new economic strategy that delivers higher productivity and strong growth.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
After the death of Queen Elizabeth, there have been increasing calls for Britain to return some of its loot from former colonies. For instance, South Africans are demanding the return of the country's diamonds that are now adorning the British crown jewels. A South African reacting to the death of Queen Elizabeth said Britain must give back all what it plundered from his country.
You know, and as an African, as someone that was colonized by the British, you know, we don't feel the way the rest of the world feel. In fact, the British people must give our land back, our diamonds back, our heritage. And that's something that we will always ask for.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya. and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are discussing reactions in Africa following the death of Queen Elizabeth, including demands for return of what Britain looted during the colonial era in the continent. We shall also be highlighting the humiliation of African leaders in London during the funeral of the British monarch. The second part of our program is on plans by the United States to counter Russia in Africa and the opposition of African leaders to this malicious objective. Stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subjects.
UK's plundering and humiliation of Africa. Calls have grown in South Africa following the death of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II for the return of a stunning gem stolen from the country. South Africans are demanding the return of the Great Star of Africa, which is kept with other jewels in the Tower of London. This South African diamond is the largest known clear-cut diamond in the whole world and sits on the end of one of the Queen's scepters. It's known as the Great Star of Africa and was part of a larger diamond which was looted from South Africa and handed to the royal family while it was under British rule in 1905.
Due to the plunder of their country by Britain during colonial rule and the continued humiliation of African leaders, many South Africans refused to mourn Queen Elizabeth. The leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, Julius Malema, was among those who categorically refused to mourn the British monarch.
It will be wrong of me to leave this mic without saying to Britain and everybody else who care, we do not mourn the death of a colonizer and a murderer who came and killed our people, and she's wearing proudly a stolen goods on her head. We have nothing to do.
To discuss more on Britain's looting of Africa and the recent humiliation of African leaders during the funeral of Queen Elizabeth, we have contacted Tshetso Magama, a former member of South African Parliament. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what's your take on the demands by South Africans that Britain must return the diamonds stolen from the country?
African colonies in particular, but colonies in the global south by European countries, in particular Britain in this case, but also France and Portugal and Germany, that colonialism and imperialism was brutal. And largely it, of course, focused not only on stealing people from our continent, but also stealing the resources of our continent. And so returning, you know, the stolen goods is perhaps the least that that Britain can do. I mean, if you look at the crown of the British Queen Elizabeth, there is a famous diamond right in the center. It's a huge diamond of over 3,000 carats, you know, and that diamond was taken out in Pretoria. It's called the Cullinan Diamond, and of course was sent to Britain, and it then found its way into the crown of Elizabeth. And so it's absolutely crucial for us, especially Africans in general, but also, of course, other people in the global south who were victims of colonialism, especially European colonialism, that Europe does the right thing, and in this case, particular Britain does the right thing, and at least return the stolen goods.
The death of Queen Elizabeth evoked memories of Britain's brutal colonial past in Africa and all countries that were colonized by Western powers. A Kenyan political analyst, Patrick Gathara, gives his take here on the refusal by many in Africa to mourn Queen Elizabeth.
There's a tendency by some to sort of say, well, the past is the past, just ignore it. It's a nice old lady who has passed. But I'm also encouraged by the fact that there's quite, especially online, quite a vocal a number of people who are refusing to be taken in by this. We're insisting that, no, the history has to be told as it is. We've got to remember it as it is. And especially now, when all these tributes are flowing, when all the when the fundamentals of that history are being laid down, that we don't accept to be erased any longer, that our stories have to be included in there, the good along with the bad.
The resolute anti-colonial stance by young people in Africa is seen as sending a message to the British government and other colonial powers that they will not be absolved from their crimes.
No, well, the message must be clear, you know, to the British Parliament, but also to other former colonizers of Africans, that Africans will not brook that kind of behavior anymore, that Europe, you know, and European countries, and Britain in this case, is not absolved from its historic crimes and atrocities and theft that and plunder, of course, of the African continent, and that Africans have reached a point where they demand, you know, restoration of what was taken, both in terms of blood and treasure from the African continent. And so the reaction of our people on the continent was quite predictable because our people are tired of colonialism and, of course, its contemporary offspring, neocolonialism, which, of course, still subjugates the African continent to the whims and whims of the imperialist North. Of course, today it finds expression in various ways. And so it's really a rejection, a visceral rejection of the African people of European colonialism.
Britain colonized and plundered Africa, and London still continues to humiliate Africans and their leaders.
The most recent instance is when African leaders attended the funeral of Queen Elizabeth. They were moved around in a bus while other world leaders, including the U.S. president, arrived in their official cars. Now, many Africans have expressed total displeasure with the way their leaders were humiliated in London. Now, what does this say about Britain's attitude towards other countries and especially African countries?
Look, Britain hasn't changed, not a bit. But it's also a reflection on our leaders in this continent, because as you would have seen on social media and elsewhere, Africans reacted to our leaders attending the funeral of the British Queen, you know, Elizabeth, and many were saying, look, those leaders do not represent us. Yes, they occupy the offices of prime ministers and presidents, but they do not represent us. And so the behavior of the British in really, you know, humiliating African leaders really is just a repetition, you know, or at least it's in conformity with how they have always treated Africans.
Well, to add on to that, many in Africa are saying that African leaders should not have attended the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II. Do you agree?
These neo-colonialists and imperialists clearly are unreformed and unreformable. And so the African continent, you know, will have to take its own destiny in its own hands and take responsibility for the decisions that it takes. But it was indeed an extremely disappointing, you know, act by our leaders in the first place to attend the funeral of a woman who has never apologized on behalf of the monarchy for all the atrocities and plunder of the African continent. In fact, you will note that when she ascended to the throne, there were still many colonies, you know, under her reign as African queen. She never saw it fit to apologize to an African. And so the behavior of the new British King Charles III that we saw when he even refused to shake the hands, you know, of a person of African descent, of a black person who was in the long line in the throngs of people that were there, is a clear indication of the absolute racism, you know, of the British monarchy, and of course the system that he represents, which of course is British and European domination of peoples in the global south.
In March this year, Britain's Prince William and his wife Kate visited Caribbean countries where they were met by activists demanding reparations for slavery amid growing scrutiny of the British Empire's colonial legacy.
60 years of independence, we have not forgotten, and we demand an apology and reparations.
There have been calls for reparations following the atrocities committed by Britain against Africans during the slave trade and the colonial era. Now, do you think the death of Queen Elizabeth will increase these calls?
Well, I certainly hope so. In fact, we have seen this movement, you know, a build-up over the past 10 to 15 years or so, where Africans are indeed making that call for reparations. This culminated, for instance, in the Germans, you know, agreeing to pay reparations to Namibia for the horrible genocide they committed of the Herero people, where they wiped out about almost 75% of the Herero population. And so definitely there is that movement, you know, calling for reparations. Now it's a different matter altogether if you know, the West, in broadly, but Britain in this case in particular.
Well, indeed, African nations need to continue demanding reparations for crimes and atrocities committed by colonial powers, especially Britain. I'd like to thank our guest today, Mr. Tshetso Magama, a former member of South African Parliament, for his incisive analysis. We'll now take a short break before our next topic, which is on opposition to U.S. attempts to impose sanctions on African countries trading with Russia. Stay with us.
Africa opposes U.S. sanctions on Russia. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has warned U.S. President Joe Biden over a piece of legislation that has passed through the U.S. House of Representatives, which will require a strategy to counter Russia's role in Africa. Ramaphosa made the remarks during a meeting with Biden in Washington last September, where he defended South Africa neutrality.
The legislation, called the Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act, has yet to clear the U.S. Senate. If passed, the legislation is expected to have repercussions for African countries.
Addressing a meeting with the U.S. Congress Black Caucus in Washington, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa voiced opposition to the U.S. bill that seeks to act against African countries that support Russian activities on the continent.
We're therefore concerned about the possible implications for the African continent if the Countering Malign Russia Activities Bill were to become a U.S. law. The law could have the unintended consequence of punishing the African continent for efforts to advance development and growth. Both the U.S. and Russia are strategic partners for South Africa. As a sovereign country that pursues an independent foreign policy, the bill could punish those who hold independent views.
Now, for more on attempts by the United States to stop the rapidly improving ties between Russia and Africa, we have contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as we have there, President Ramaphosa has warned the U.S. again is punishing African nations for maintaining ties with Russia. Now, he firmly told Biden that South Africa should not be told by anyone who to associate with. What's your opinion on this stance by President Ramaphosa?
Well, first, I think the statement by President of South Africa, Ramaphosa, is a reflection of also the solidification of African leadership to take a stand against intimidation, the customary Western intimidation. So actually, it also follows after the African countries took a vote. Their vote in the United Nations was not to condemn the Russians as the United States, Russia as the United States was urging it. So this is kind of a development that we are seeing for the first time in a while of the African countries.
Now, do you think the statement by Ramaphosa will compel the U.S. to reconsider its policy of forcing African countries to downgrade ties with Russia?
So I don't see it changing the position of the United States, them rethinking anything. I think it's one of a series of moves that's indicating the multipolarism that's happened emerging in the world, and that the leadership of different countries and even the people of different countries and following suit of their population is not standing for the unilateralism that comes with U.S. and Western European neoliberal order. But the West is committed to that. And I think as a capitalist system, as a capitalist economy that is sustained and dependent on the super exploitation of the world, they really have no other choice but to continue on the track that they're going. So I don't think Ramaphosa's statement or anything really is going to change the mind of the West.
Kenyan President William Ruto has said his country would consider buying Russian oil to deal with skyrocketing fuel prices in his country. This statement is seen as a signal of simmering African resistance to U.S. sanctions on Russia.
As we mentioned before, there is a resistance to it. The West has been trying to convince the rest of the world the economic dire situation in terms of access to wheat, access to oil, and these things are the fault of the Russians, but they're the fault of sanctions. And it's clear for anybody to see, and that people are really suffering as a result. We've seen a global crisis as a result of U.S. insistence on continue its proxy war against Russia through Ukraine, and people are, you know, people are fed up with that, and even the leadership of countries.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in a speech at the UN General Assembly, cited that the Western sanctions imposed on Russia prevented the supply of grain as well as fertilizers to the poor of Africa.
The impediments by U.S. and EU, the financial and logistical impediments against our grain and fertilizers, have not been lifted. Furthermore, for several weeks we have been saying that about 300,000 tons of fertilizer are being held up in European ports, and we have been proposing that they be forwarded free of charge to the needy countries in Africa. But the European Union is not heeding this.
The UN has failed to take decisive action to counter oppressive unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against countries such as Iran and Cuba. Therefore, the UN, with its current structure, is unlikely to challenge U.S. sanctions against Russia that will certainly lead to loss of lives in Africa.
Unfortunately, the United Nations is still pretty much it's the way it's structured, with the Security Council being the most powerful entity within it, and still it being dominated by Western agenda, that it's very unlikely that the United Nations as a body will be in a position to do anything against the unilateral U.S. sanctions. They haven't been able to do anything against unilateral sanctions against other countries.
African countries have been calling for the urgent need to reform the United Nations to prevent countries such as the U.S. from misusing this organization, especially the Security Council. In his address to the UN General Assembly last September, the president of Malawi, Lazarus Chakwera, slammed the politicization of human suffering.
But if we are truly one UN family, then leaving no one behind has to be practiced, not just preached. If we are truly one UN family, we must reject any attempts to politicize human suffering by lobbying us to refuse the help of those some find politically offensive. If we are truly one UN family, we must get out of political posturing and welcome more helping hands in resolving the problems the permanent UN Security Council members have sometimes created and which they have failed to solve alone, namely the failure to stop environmental degradation, the failure to prevent unjust wars, the failure to lift unsustainable debt burdens, the failure to prevent food insecurity, and the failure to contain pandemics.
Now, after Russia started its military operation in Ukraine in February, the United States and European governments have been forcing African countries not to support Moscow. Some African countries have defied the West and openly supported Russia, while many have taken a non-aligned position. Now, what is the future of African ties with the West and Russia, and will the continent be able to emerge as a truly non-aligned region?
I think what has to happen in Africa, we're seeing promising positions taken by African leaders against Western imperialism. But the problem is they still have their own class interests. They still have too much invested in Western imperialism. And so what really has to happen in Africa is where there be their emergence of people-centered movements, participatory democracy, a transformation of the governments and neocolonialism to socialist governments. There has to be that, something that's responsive, not only responsive to the people, but of the people themselves. And if we have that, then we can see that any type of relationships on in the world that Africa has, the African countries have with Russia or with China or whatever, will be set in the best interest of the African people. Right now, those relationships are dependent on the comprador class, which has been nurtured and is given and sustained by Western imperialism.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up today. Our guest there says ties between Africa and Russia are based on mutual friendship, unlike Western countries that impose their will on African nations. I'd like to thank Mr. Nefla Freeman for his insight today. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
When speaking about inequality and discrimination, the first country that comes to mind is the United States of America, or, as the situation goes on, the disunited States of America. In just a small example, Forbes this past spring counted up some 2,668 billionaires on its annual list of global private fortunes that run at least 10 digits. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "Billionaires have become a truly worldwide phenomenon. Forbes this past spring counted up some 2,668 billionaires on its annual list of global private fortunes that run at least 10 digits. And now, the Credit Suisse Research Institute has just published its broader annual census of the world's super rich, an analysis that finds grand mega-million fortunes in nearly every nation. But some nations, the Credit Suisse analysis also shows, host far more of these fortunes than others. And one nation, the United States of America, sits in a wealth class all its own. The United States boasts 39.2% of the world's millionaires. China sits second at 9.9%, with Japan third at 5.4%. The contrast becomes even more striking as we step up even higher into the world of the fabulously wealthy. Some 53% of the global deep pockets worth at least $100 million call the United States of America home. What explains this overwhelming U.S. dominance within the ranks of the world's super rich? The release of another new annual set of stats from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. points to one prime piece of answer: corporate executive compensation. The Economic Policy Institute has emerged over recent years as America's most perceptive source of CEO pay data. An analyst from the Institute earlier this week released their latest yearly update. The headline stat from this new EPI analysis says corporate chiefs at the 350 top American firms that trade on the stock market last year realized an average $27.8 million in compensation, an 11.5%